on the road or off-road, Chevy Silverado is built for tough performance in any condition. Hit the road in a new Silverado pickup. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for a dealer near you. Chevy Silverado, official truck partner of the Chicago Bears.
You remember this song, right?
I have heard this before. Somewhere.
That's a guy named Gary Loizo. The group is The American Breed. Bend Me, Shape Me. I think hit number five. The band and Gary are from Cicero, Illinois. And his son's going to join us in just a minute here as we get the show started for reasons that we'll explain. Ooh. I didn't know that. I didn't know that had a Cicero, Illinois connection.
I knew they were from Chicago, but I did not know Cicero.
Yeah, how about that? American Breed. And, of course, that song's enjoyed a kind of a second life because it's been used in commercials, too. If I were writing music, I think I would try and, you know, find my muse, find my soul, express it, and then think, how could Mercedes use this? Or Target, or I don't know, some company that might want to pay me a lot of money, or my children someday, right?
I don't mailbox money.
Oh, yeah, no kidding, really. You just open up the mailbox and go, hey, here's a check. It's funny, too, though, Bob, you know more about the music business than I do, but there are some people whose song lyrics or performances, I get them residuals over the years, but it's 28 cents, too. You know, I won't pretend to make sense of all of it. I know some of them have comfortable lives with the song, and some of them you think, oh, you didn't get the right kind of contract, did you?
Yeah, early on, they were so glad maybe to, oh, you mean we get to use this recording studio?
And yeah.
You'll get all the publishing?
You'll play, sure. That's fine. We'll write another song. Well, maybe you won't. So in the second hour, we'll talk to the author of Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder, Inside the Minds of History's Great Personalities, a lady named Claudia Kalb. And I've been reading her book, and it's really interesting. She just, you know, it's not a prescription for anything. It's just saying, let's figure out who these people were, how their minds worked, what their troubles were, how they worked around them, and that's in part how we know them. She writes about Frank Lloyd Wright this way, and I'm not going to tell people in Chicago anything they don't already know, but it's just so interesting. Here's a paragraph. She writes, rooted in nonconformity, the maverick architect pursued his artistic convictions with little concern for the utilitarian manners of stability, practicality, and cost. Organic simplicity and aesthetics mattered above all else, and Wright pushed the limits using non-traditional materials and unusual designs to achieve his ideals. His buildings were notorious for their physical defects, including inadequately heated rooms and drooping beams, leaky roofs, an unwelcome feature of his flat-topped buildings were practically an architectural insignia. Even Wright's most resolute admirers could not help but pay homage to the depths of what a sociologist and architecture critic Lewis Mumford described as Wright's, quote, colossal self-admiration. Wright's behaviors line up with far more deeply entrenched mental health diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. Quote, early in life, he said, I had to choose between honest arrogance and hypocritical humility. I chose the former and have seen no reason to change.
Worked out all right for him, I think, besides the leaky roofs. But,
yeah. Well, there's still
all
a lot
all?
Of... Yeah, I know. Well, to be honest with you, I'm just going to say this, and then don't stone me. I've never been a big lover of his architecture. I get it. It seems to work for people, and I guess it's a sort of art that I don't thoroughly appreciate. But if the roof leaks, I think you got to own that, dude. Well, anyway, Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder is the title of the book, and it's about a whole host of famous people. You know, what drove them and what drove them to distraction. We'll talk about that in our 2 o'clock hour. There was a story on the CBS Morning News this week about a woman who ran 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. Did you see that story? How about that? But it dawned on me as I was watching that story that I know it's a pretty good marathoner, and that is a guy, Todd Loizo, thank you, Griffin, whose father was the guy whose music we were listening to a moment ago, Gary Loizo. And Todd joins us now on WGN. Hi, Todd. How are you?
How you doing, John? Thanks for having me.
You still live in Chicago, do you?
I sure do. Born and raised 20 miles from where I grew up. I live in Plainfield.
You and I have a mutual friend, a guy named Rick Hegberg. He's one of my cousins. And he said, well, shoot, my friend Todd ran 50 marathons in 50 states in 14 years. Just recently finishing your last marathon. Was it 51? Did you include Washington, D.C. in the count?
That is correct. 50 states in Washington, D.C. I finished last October.
Well, I hope you don't mind my starting this interview, just looking back at your dad, because while he did have that hit, he was also well known as being the recording engineer and producer, if I recall, for Styx, right?
That is correct. After The American Breed, he redefined himself as a producer and sound recording engineer. Started Pumpkin Studios, and for the next 40 years, he recorded the Styx albums, REO Speedwagon, Survivor, all the main Chicago acts, and was nominated for 2 Grammy Awards for his work with Styx as well.
Just passed away a few weeks ago.
January 16th, correct.
Yeah. So our condolences to you all. He had cancer, right?
That's correct. He fought pancreatic cancer for about 3 years, and I'm proud to say he was one of the one percenters. So he made it much further than we all expected, and we were grateful for the time.
By that you mean that disease takes people so quickly. He lived on the edge of the curve. He lived longer than most people do with the diagnosis.
That is correct. That is correct.
Or do you mean like he got fabulously wealthy because of all of his great songs?
It was the former. It was the former. But he did very well.
Yeah. Well, so talk to me. We'll come back to maybe that in a minute, but let's talk about what we said we would, and that was the 50 marathons in 50 states. Whatever inspired you to do that, and why didn't your wife and children leave you?
It's a great question. I'll get to that in a second. But this journey started when I supported a friend who ran the Chicago Marathon in 2000, and I was so enthralled with the challenge and the crazy amount of energy that surrounds a marathon. And I just said I had to try this. As I was training for the first race, I read about someone who was attempting to do this in all 50 states. And I just thought this is exactly the kind of life adventure I'd love to take on. And I always wanted to travel the country, and it gave me an excuse to go to places I'd never go otherwise.
And, first time I saw my wife. Keep going.
I was going to say, over the next 14 years, my wife Heather and my boy Jack, they've been to all 51 races. And my other son Ben, who was born in 2003, he was to all 48. So I'd never run a state without him. And it brought us to places like Maine and Alaska and, geez, even Delaware, places we'd never go otherwise. It was great.
So the family knew that until Dad gets done with this, whenever we see a vacation coming up or some free time, we're going to get out the Atlas. We're going to say, okay, we haven't won one in New Mexico. We better go see what's going on there, huh?
Yeah, they're tired. They got tired of going to 50-degree weather kind of places because marathons are usually in the colder time of year. So, yes, they are leveraging all of this very well and pushing me to go to Hawaii and Disney this summer. So
yeah.
I'll take care of them. They've earned that.
I think you owe them that. The first time a marathon went by me, and I don't know if you were a track athlete or cross-country runner. I was never a long-distance runner, but the first time a marathon went by me, I was impressed with how athletic a lot of the people did not look. And I thought,
right.
You know, I could, if she can do that, if he can do that, I could probably do this. What was your best time that you ever ran a marathon?
You know, the best time I ever ran was 3 hours and 58 minutes, and that was at the Disney Marathon when I was a young pup years ago. And I'll tell you, the body gets through it. You would be amazed. I think anybody can absolutely run one. Now, when I've run so many over the years, I had to be more of a donkey than a racehorse to get through a lot of these because it is tough on the body. And, you know, a lot of times I do 6 and 7 in 1 year. So I had to take it a little bit slower. I got slower as I got older.
So you might do it in 5 hours or 6 hours.
Exactly, depending.
And, you know, maybe that's the way to do it. I mean, the times that I've run them, I've run a few, and I see people like me who we're not going to set any world records. And I thought, why are we killing ourselves to run this thing fast? We're not going to win. Maybe better to run
that's
it.
That's correct.
Maybe better to run it in 5.5 hours than try and get – I appreciate goals, and under 4 is a thing. But really, it's
anybody
a thing.
Anybody who runs knows running fast is painful, and yeah. running a fast marathon is painful. So I chose the enjoyment route more than I did the painful route.
So what was yeah, the – what's the moral of the story? I mean – did you come away with some grand truths after doing this or as you were doing this?
Oh, grand truths and is, that's a good question. I haven't thought about that.
I think the answer is no. I mean, it's, it sounds like it was more the way you described it, an adventure for the family. Hey, this is a way for us to see the country, be into something, have something to do.
Absolutely. It really was a great way for – it was more about traveling the country with my family than it was about running the individual races. And, you know, we will absolutely cherish the fact that we've all been to all 50 states, seen things we've never have seen before. And, hey, if there's one moral that we all get out of this is, you know, absolutely do not quit. Continue until you get to that finish line. And I'm hoping my kids will carry that through as they get older.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, they're sponges. They pick stuff up that you don't think sometimes, and that can be a good thing. What was the hardest marathon you ran?
Oh, the hardest marathon I'd ran. I've done marathons such as Pikes Peak where you start at 7,000, you go all the way up to 14,000 feet and then back down. That's tough, but honestly, the hardest marathons have been when your body just wasn't clicking that day. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Either it was really cold, you didn't feel well. Heck, there was a couple of races where I had to run 8 times around a 3-mile loop lake. And those can be painful, the monotony, and if your body's not feeling right. So yeah, some of those can be tough.
That's a bad marathon. Whoever laid that out needs to take a creativity class or, I don't know, a geography class.
It was awful. You'd be at, you know, loop 6 and you'd think you'd be at loop 7 instead, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But when you try to run this many, you have to just take the marathons that are in front of you, and you don't get to pick and choose. Depends on the kids' schedules and your schedule. So I had to do what I had to do to get done by October. That was my goal.
We're talking with a marathoner, although you told me you're not a – how did you put it? You're not a marathon runner? What was your line about that, Gary?
I'm not a marathon runner. I'm just a dude who runs marathons. That's the way I like to see it.
Todd Loizzo's on the line. Okay, but you finished in Washington, D.C., and there's a nice part of this story that you'll tell in a minute here on WGN. Yeah. Six on WGN. This is John Williams. The Mincing Rascals sure have something to say about how we decide who the next Supreme Court justice should be. And what they had to say about Madigan and Rauner, and for that matter, Hillary Clinton this week, are all coming your way after the 1:30 edition of WGN Radio News. I'm John Williams. You can find me here on Saturdays from 1 to 3 and on Facebook. I'm King John. I'm talking with Todd Loizzo. His dad was Gary Loizzo from The American Breed. You remember Ben Me Shape Me, but you also remember him as one of the key guys behind the scenes on the band Styx, passed away recently. But you know, prior to your dad's passing, you had made a decision after 2000 to run 50 marathons, 51 really, one in each state. You included Washington, D.C., and D.C. was your last stop. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
And how did that work? Was that just random, or was there a reason for that?
No. I wanted to get all the states done, and I saw Washington, D.C. as a very patriotic way to finish my quest. And I had 30 members come out from my family, which was just wonderful. And I'd say the most what made the last one so special for me is that my dad did travel a lot. In addition to the studio work he did with Styx, he was also the main sound engineer in the arena tours that Styx did. So he was gone for several years on the road and wasn't able to get to my marathon. So he always said, hey, I'm going to make the last one no matter what. And as he got a couple of years into his illness, basically said, Todd, I don't know how much longer I got left here, but I really need to be at your last one. It's very important to me. And I said, it's just as important to me. So what I did was the last 8 months, I said, I'm going to take every marathon I can, get these 50 done so we can do the 51st in October. I ended up running 8 marathons this year. And my dad really started to get sick in the October timeframe, but he did an experimental surgery actually in LA and flew from LA all the way out to Washington, D.C. one day after his surgery. And I got to hug him 100 feet from the finish line. We got to say we did it. And it was absolutely a perfect close on this quest for me. Nothing better that both of us got to hug each other at that finish line. That was a big milestone for him and I.
Yeah, and maybe a perfect close for him, too. I don't know if he knew how much time he had left, but he probably could put two and two together there, eh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep.
Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. Well, that's touching. Well, what a – and was that the most you ran last year, was 8 in 1 year?
It was. That was the most I ran.
And you had to get all 8 in if you wanted to hug your dad before he passed away. So now it's now you're wishing you'd done more in 2004 or something like that. But that's
absolutely right. So, yeah, I had to crunch them all in the end, and I'm grateful that we both got there.
Yeah, what a touch. Well, what a wonderful story. You know, your dad left us with a lot of great music, and that's a great story, Todd. It's nice of you to tell it, and you and I should meet in person sometime.
I'd like that. Thank you for letting me share it, John. Appreciate it.
Todd Loizzo is a Chicagoan. 50 marathons, 50 states, 51 actually, include D.C. in the last 14 years. It's 129. We'll pause for the news. The Mincing Rascals have a few things to say. That's coming up on WGN. Thank you, Bob. You know, on Saturdays, I plug that podcast we do because we broadcast it. I'd like you to hear it either on your phone or listen to it here on WGN Radio. And so here we go again with another exciting edition of something we call the Mincing Rascals, the podcast that you can subscribe to or listen to excerpted every Saturday around 1:37 here on WGN, and that's the current time. The Mincing Rascals are Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio, the columnist in the Tribune, Eric Zorn, and one of the editorial writers at the Trib, Kristen McQuarrie. We kick around a bunch of issues. It's about a half-hour podcast this week, a few minutes of which today go a little bit like this. I was talking to the gang about how it seems as though Hollywood is writing the script for not only the presidential elections, but also this Supreme Court nomination process. And we begin with Steve Bertrand saying,
more Hollywooder?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And so Sandra Day O'Connor, now the Reagan appointee, the first woman on the bench, is saying, come on, Senate, you got to get along with this and do your job. I don't know how this is all going to play, but that Mitch McConnell, within what? I've heard 10 minutes.
Less than 24 hours.
Oh, less than an hour or two after it was announced, said, don't bother sending replacement, and which was just bad form, I think. I mean, it might be the way they're going to play it, but my God, let's celebrate, even though I didn't agree with a lot of his decisions. Give the guy his due.
Well, if I had to bet, and now I'm jumping the gun here, but I don't think there's any way that the Senate approves any nominee of the president before January. You agree with me on that?
I don't know. You know, depending on who he nominates, and there have been some, senators starting to give themselves a little wiggle room on it. I mean, I'd like to see them work together and get a consensus candidate, right? That would be the ideal. I think that might still happen because I think if they don't, I think it really works against the Republicans. I think long-term, it's going to do them, short-term, I should say, it will do them more damage than if they hold off and fight it.
It was just an unserious thing to do, I thought, coming out that quickly and saying no way, no how. It's one of the things, you wait a couple of days and you let the news sink in, and then you say, well, of course we're going to do our duty. Of course we're going to.
Yeah, and then don't.
And then when it comes along, you say, well, this candidate is clearly unacceptable. I mean, it's just the kind of thing that you whisper to one another in the cloakroom.
Yeah, jumping the gun doesn't buy you any advantage. What's the point of that?
It struck me as a bookend, right, because McConnell was known for, at the very beginning of Obama's administration, saying what we're going to do here is do everything we can to see that he doesn't win a second term. And now at the end of his second term, or toward it, he's saying, well, this term is basically over and we're going to do everything we can
to keep him from exercising the powers of his office.
But I don't want to go down that road because Chuck Schumer said things before that will haunt Democrats, and Ronald Reagan said things that would encourage us to look past partisan politics when we're picking a judge. So
Barack Obama was involved in delaying
Alito.
Exactly.
He filibustered Alito. So.
But I don't know. Either side can find fuel for their fire if they look far enough back. I really think, of course, this is me having voted for Obama and wanting his appointee to be on the Supreme Court, but I'll still finish this statement. I think we should live in the present. The president has a duty, and the Senate has an obligation to at least consider it.
What does Justice McQuarrie think about this?
Yeah, no kidding.
Conspicuously
silent. I think she hung up a long time ago.
She's having another horseshoe.
I actually agree with John that, you know, I understand Republicans wanting to wait for the next president because there are cases before the Supreme Court right now that could now tip in a different direction if Obama gets to make an appointment. But you know what? That's life. I agree with John that you can't. I mean, we know Washington politicizes everything. We know Mitch McConnell politicizes everything. I don't think they're going to do the right thing, but I think the right thing is to at least go through the appointment process.
You don't think we'll get a new appointee before January?
No.
It's going to be a lot harder on the Republicans when there's an actual face, when there's someone who has been nominated, and you know that whoever is nominated is going to have pretty good credentials. And is not going to be someone who's...
That Srees Ranasinghe guy, the 48-year-old Indian-American who was approved 97-0 to a federal court. The entire Senate has already weighed in on his credentials unanimously.
And stalling or rejecting that nomination simply because it came from Barack Obama is just not going to look good.
And won't that hurt them?
Yeah, it's going to look great to half of the country who identify themselves as Republicans and don't want to see the appointment. I mean, I don't think people, as we go through these primaries, are going to be paying that close of attention to a held-up Supreme Court nominee.
I think they're going to pay attention to this one.
I think it's bad for the Republicans in the November election if they're the ones seeing not living up to the constitutional requirement.
But I want to make sure I understand Kristen correctly. Are you saying that you don't think this is going to be an election issue, Kristen?
I don't think it's going to be that prominent where it's going to make people switch their votes in a presidential race because the Senate Republicans are sitting on a Supreme Court nominee.
I agree with that. I don't think they're going to switch votes. I think what may happen, though, is that it may motivate one side or the other to vote more. And this is why this is such an interesting thing to have happen, which is that, to me, the Supreme Court is always a huge issue in every election. And I have a memory that last week after the podcast, Steve, you and I and Kristen were talking about the Supreme Court and why isn't it a bigger issue? We were just talking on the way to the elevator. Why isn't it a bigger issue in these elections? Because it is so important to the direction of the country who's on the Supreme Court. And yet, in survey after survey, voters don't put that very high. This year, it's going to be a really big concern. And that's, I think it's going to motivate a lot of people to come out and vote. I don't know which side right now, but I think what you're suggesting, John and Steve, is that it's going to motivate Democrats because they're going to be more outraged.
Look, the Democrats may well do it as well or would have done it as well. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying I don't think it's going to play well for them in the election.
Plus, if Barack Obama does give them at least a somewhat passable moderate, maybe they would be wise to take that now rather than gamble. What if Hillary wins? Well, then and she's got 4 years to sit on some appointments. At some point, they're going to have to deal with it then. Maybe better to deal with it now or get somebody palatable.
Or President Sanders nominates Michael Moore. Right?
Hillary Clinton, by the way, let's segue over to, are we done talking about the presidential candidates? Any surprises?
You're a liar. You're a liar.
Yeah. If the Republicans continue to call each other and the Democrats liars, but it's coming out of their mouths, at some point, the lasting effect is going to be that you're going to think, oh, yeah, Republicans, what did I hear? Oh, yeah, they're liars. Where did I get that? Well, Cruz and Trump and Rubio all said that about Cruz and Trump and Rubio. And so even though they're trying to score individual points, they're so damaging the brand that I think that's really bad for their party right now.
I feel like we're getting into the, although we're already in the circus, now we're in second act, and so you're just going to see these candidates say anything to try to get a moment of attention. They are going to damage whoever emerges as the nominee if they keep going down this road.
Hillary Clinton came out against, of all things, Governor Rauner's budget. Kristen, did that resonate at all in Springfield? Did you all hear that? The speeches were going on simultaneously, but she sure took a shot at Governor Rauner.
Yeah, who cares what Hillary Clinton says, honest to God, about the... Go back to New York. York, where you've lived for the past 20 years, stay out of our mess, and acknowledge that it's your party who got us here.
Kristen, you were there for that speech. Did you hear much that was new?
Governor Rauner's budget address.
Yes, I'm sorry. Governor Rauner's speech, yes.
I would say he took a little bit more of a baby step toward compromising when he said that he acknowledges not all of his turnaround agenda needs to happen right away. So to me, that was a little bit more of him saying, all right, I'll back off on these poison pills of collective bargaining. I also think he really did not attack public employee unions. There aren't really that many areas where he can just singularly go and strike out the budget, and he needs the legislature to allow him to do that.
What are the chances they're going to help him out on that, Kristen?
Probably zero. What? I mean, I don't, in my opinion, the legislature rules by Democrats, and with Mike Madigan sitting there and his daughter potentially waiting in the wings to run for governor, I just don't see them being willing to give him any sort of a victory.
Boy, there you go down that road again. You have 2 weeks in a row brought up the specter of his daughter wanting to be governor is shading Mike Madigan's actions. That's amazing to me.
Why?
Because that is so personal and literally petty compared to a state that's $6.5 billion in the hole. I mean, that's just ludicrous to me.
I know this sounds frivolous, but I'm genuinely interested in you guys and what you think of the governor's use of the...
Oh, here it comes. I know. Go ahead.
The G, dropping his G's. And, I anchored his speech yesterday on WGN Radio. And the second thing out of it that I said was, and frankly, the texts were overwhelming, was all about his elocution. And so I brought it up, and I was feeling a little guilty afterward. And I just wonder what you guys think, because on the one hand, I don't think you can fake that over and over. But on the other hand, as a guy who grew up on the fringes of downstate, when he says stuff like bankrupting, you know, I feel like he's talking down to me. I think he's thinking downstaters are kind of stupid, or this is how they talk, so this is how I'm going to get him on my side. And it just bothers me, but I could be completely wrong.
But he absolutely doesn't talk that way in private or in other settings.
Do we know? I don't know. I don't know how you could only do it in a speech.
There's some recordings of him back before he was a candidate, before he was a politician, when he was on Chicago Tonight, where he doesn't drop nearly as many G's. I actually count. He dropped 50. He dropped 51% of his G's yesterday.
He did
62% in the state of the state. So he's actually improved a little bit.
So is it? What do you guys think? Is it legitimate? Is it fake?
Your colleague at WGN Radio, Ro Khan, made this an issue since his acceptance speech. He said, wait a minute, what's that? What's that? And it's made him kind of a laughingstock's not the right word, but it is so noticeable. You think he'd work on it. You know, he wasn't a public enough figure. I don't remember what he sounded like beforehand. I suppose it's possible a super-duper rich guy drops his G's.
Kristen?
I mean, you asked the critical question, is this how he talked, you know, prior to being a candidate? And we don't really know that. I think it's both. I think he did sort of drop G's from the first few times that he came into the Tribune editorial board. And those are the only times I've interacted with him. He is this billionaire who speaks that way. But when he gets in front of an audience, I think he amps it up, or it's his way of trying to relate. I don't think it's condescending, because actually, I mean, Southern Illinois, they do speak differently. They have a Southern accent.
Okay, but when I go down there, I don't try to speak like them to get them to see things my way.
Well, it seems a miscalculation anyway, because most of the state isn't in Southern Illinois. I mean, if anything, he should talk like a Southsider. You know, if he really wanted to, rally the troops, do they talk in Madigan's district?
Do the Madigan-Lipinski, right.
Those are the Mincing Rascals. Each week, posted on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook. You can subscribe to them on iTunes. Mincing Rascals. Thank you, Eric Zorn, Kristen McQuarrie from the Tribune, and WGN Radio's own Steve Bertrand. The recommendations from the gang and the Bernie Sanders story today takes an interesting twist, doesn't it? All coming up here on WGN. Okay, so at the end of each podcast, the end of each broadcast with the Mincing Rascals, we ask the gang to recommend something they are reading, listening to, or watching from that podcast. Here's what the gang had to say.
I was at the University of Chicago Folk Festival last weekend playing music with people like I like to do down there. I was jamming, and this young woman sort of playing fiddle with me, and I found out who she was, and her name was Heather Maliuk, and she's got this band I discovered called Glass Mountain with her and Sarah Laginski and Ari Bolas, and They're just three young women, and they play Appalachian style folk music, and they do original stuff, and they're just wonderful. I went and bought their album online, and it was really terrific. So one of those little serendipitous moments that you get when you hang out with musicians.
Glass Mountain.
Glass Mountain, yes.
Nice shout out for them.
I'll keep the theme going if you don't mind.
Yeah, please.
I feel great pressure from you guys to find something to talk about.
Yeah, this is the hardest part of the podcast.
It is for me. And so last night I watched the documentary about Glen Campbell, I'll Be Me, which has been out for a couple of years. You're familiar with it?
Yeah, I know the story, I don't know
the movie.
Okay, right. No.
So he had come out with his album, and just as he did, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And then he goes on this tour across country, and he played at Ravinia. He did a benefit here in Chicago during it. I think it was 2012. And the camera just follows him and then other musicians who are impacted by Alzheimer's. And it just shows Glen Campbell. First of all, it's incredibly revealing. And it shows him as this very sweet, affable sort of country boy kind of man. But he's incapable. I mean, he goes out on stage and they have to show him where to stand. They have a teleprompter in front of him with the lyrics. And if he starts to wander, they know it could go off the rails at any time. Hmm. And all of this is just laid bare in this film. You know, a remarkable guy and who's given us so much music, but he's leaving with a completely different but an equally remarkable gift.
What's the title of that again?
I'll Be Me. It's really worth seeing.
How about you, Kristen? Still down in Springfield. What's your recommendation this week?
Well, this is a column that I'm not sure if it ran in the Tribune. I saw it just online in the LA Times, but it's by Megan Dom, and it just talks a little bit more about Scalia's relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and just the larger picture that's actually applicable to our little podcast here. But it discusses a lot about, and I'll quote her here, the author, the idea that listening to another opinion can help fortify your own is almost unheard of these days. And it talks about the echo chamber of social media and just the intolerance for others' opinions and how the two of them really served as just a good example of how they fortified each other's opinions but managed to keep it civil. Hmm. So it's by Megan Dom, and it's in the Los Angeles Times.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
What a mean thing to say, Eric. I think we've lost some context there, but that's Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie from the Tribune and our own Steve Bertrand. By the way, Bob Kessler, you've played with Ariel Bowles, right?
Yes, I have, from Glass Mountain. I didn't even know she was in the group, but I heard Eric Zorn mention this group, and my ears perked up. He said, Ariel Bowles playing bass. I said, oh, well, it's actually Bowles, but anyway. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like she dropped in with him or he dropped in with her. It was kind of a spontaneous thing.
It sounds that way, yeah.
You know, you're a real fan when then you go online and pay for the music. He paid
that
money for the
fan.
Music.
Yeah.
So that's there's an endorsement. And it's Glass Mountain. Yeah, okay. Good for her, and thank you guys. By the way, my recommendation to the gang was simply to go online. This will sound so mundane, but I came about it in an interesting way. I wanted to read something about Jeb Bush, so I went to jebbush.com, which has been hijacked by a Trump supporter, and it's now a hyperlink to Donald Trump's campaign website at least 2 days ago. If you went to jebbush.com, this is classic Trump Bush, isn't it? If you go to jebbush.com, the bully
still does
has taken it away. So is that what's...
I just tried it.
Jebbush.com, you go to Donald Trump, right?
Goes immediately to Donald J. Trump.
So then I thought, what the hell, I'll read Trump stuff. And what I was interested in, and I did this with Bernie Sanders too, and I recommend this. This is my recommendation this week. It's very accessible and it's easy to read. If you go to the campaign website, just type in their name and .org or .com and click on what their financial plan is, and read about what their tax plan is. Very interesting. Kind of comical, in Bernie Sanders' case, kind of terrifying, but it's very readable, too. And as much as we get caught up in these, oh, you're a liar, no, you're a liar, and all the silliness of these elections, you know, the TV's not doing it. Just read what their tax plans are. And I don't know how you're going to find Jeb Bush's.
That's not exciting, John.
It
doesn't involve any yelling at people.
I know. I feel just a modicum of responsibility to try and guide people a little bit. The book Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder is just fascinating. The author of it joins us after the news. That's next on WGN.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Andy Warhol, silver screen.
Williams here on WGN Radio. About 8 minutes after 2 o'clock, Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder is Claudia Kalb's new book. Here's how she begins it. In a chapter actually about Marilyn Monroe, she gets to Andy Warhol and others as well. But her book begins this way: Mr. President, Marilyn Monroe. And with those words, the epic scene began. It was May 19, 1962 at Madison Square Garden. Despite warnings from advisors and her own anxiety about performing, Marilyn Monroe had agreed to serenade President John F. Kennedy at a grand fundraiser in celebration of his 45th birthday. Actor Peter Lawford, the president's brother-in-law, stood at the podium and extended his arm to welcome the actress. Spotlights lit the stage. A drum roll sounded. The actress, however, was nowhere to be seen. Lawford went at it again. A woman about whom it truly may be said she needs no introduction. Let me just say, here she is. Again, the extended arm, the spotlights, the drum roll. Again, nothing. Finally, as Lawford launched into yet another attempt, Monroe emerged, shimmying across the stage in a fur coat and flesh-colored gown so tight it was reportedly sewn together on her body. As she cozied up to the podium, Lawford made his final introduction, Mr. President, the late Marilyn Monroe. Monroe put her hands over her eyes to shield herself from the glare of the spotlight, which electrified her platinum hair and the 2,500 rhinestones decorating her dress. It was a moment rich with anticipation and body curiosity. Some 15,000 people sat expectantly in the audience. Ella Fitzgerald, Jack Benedy, Robert Kennedy, and of course the president. Monroe caressed the microphone, exhaled deeply, and then crooned her tribute.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. President, happy birthday to you.
Joining us now on WGN Radio, Claudia Kalb. Her book is Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder. Hi, Claudia. Welcome to the show. You've written about the science of our minds and our bodies before, but what an interesting collection of stories. And by the way, what a great title, Claudia. I don't know who advised you on that, but that's a killer title for a book.
It's a killer title. I thank the marketing team for that.
Really?
They know what they're doing.
That wasn't your idea?
Well, we had brainstormed a bunch of ideas, and that was in the mix of all sorts of different ones, and that one rose to the top.
So you're writing about the minds of these great personalities. Because they're great personalities or because they were troubled minds?
Really both. I mean, I think what's so interesting about all of these characters, from Andy Warhol to Princess Diana, Marilyn Monroe, Abraham Lincoln, they were great personalities, and they were great accomplished people in their own right, and yet they had troubled minds. And so kind of diving into what was behind all of that success that we all saw and know about, what was really going on behind the scenes. And they're a lot like everybody else. They had troubles, and in some of these cases, really serious troubles.
And many of them lived quite some time ago. Princess Diana is a more recent example. But I wonder if you conclude that if they had lived in more recent times, they would have had either better pharmacology or better counseling, and they might have not been so troubled. They might have been able to handle these issues they dealt with better.
I think that's definitely true of a number of them. So Marilyn Monroe is an example. She had what doctors have looked at and looks a lot like borderline personality disorder, a lot of characteristics of mood swings and impulsivity. And during the era that she was living in and trying to get help in the 1950s, she was not getting the help that they can provide today in terms of therapy. She was doing psychoanalysis. She was sort of too much in the past. Now they give people really, really good coping skills, much more hope for that condition than there was during her lifetime. And it raises the question of whether she could have been saved.
That scene of her singing Happy Birthday to the president just gets ickier all the time, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, it's so interesting. You can pull it up on YouTube and watch it. And knowing just the foreshadowing, now knowing that 3 months later she was dead, it's just so tragic. She was so troubled, and she couldn't get past these terrible yearnings. She was trying to find an identity. She never felt loved. She felt very isolated. She had a really rough childhood of orphanage and foster homes. And so in her case, just this you know, couldn't bring herself to get past it, didn't get the help she might have today.
Well, you said she wanted stability. She wanted a father figure that would have explained maybe her last marriage, but she was just on such display there. And 3 months later, she takes, I guess, her own life. That's the conclusion we're sort of left with now, right?
Right. That seems to be, and there's still swirling controversy, but it seems to appear that she died of a drug overdose, and that's a characteristic of impulsivity. She turned to medication and drugs to try to treat herself, and she couldn't do it.
The title track, though, if you will, of your book is about Andy Warhol, and you said that he is a hoarder. I don't know a lot about Andy Warhol. I know a little. I didn't know this, though, that he had, what was it, over 600 time capsules, which were essentially just real-time garbage bags for him, it sounds like.
I mean, they were incredible. He had these boxes, and he would just throw things into them as he saw fit, stuff he just pulled off his desk, even pulled stuff out of the trash can. It had bills that he hadn't paid, junk mail, some Campbell's soup cans showed up, empty toothbrush boxes, old clothing. He really threw all this stuff in these boxes, and just he said in his writings he could not give anything away. He just could not bring himself to throw stuff away and give it away. And he dreamed of a clean, clear space, he talked about, but he couldn't do it. And in his townhouse, too, after he died, they came in to assess what he had, and they couldn't even enter some of the rooms. They were so stocked with just stuff.
Don't mean that metaphorically. Literally, he was our definition. He's our vision of what we imagine a hoarder lives like.
Yes. I mean, in some cases, what you see on reality TV and hoarding is takes it to a level that's different from his. So there's a lot of dirt and squalor and maybe too many animals and that kind of thing. There are different levels and different kinds of the ways people hoard. But in his case, the characteristics of living spaces not being able to be used for what their purpose was, that was true of his home, this inability to throw anything away. He struggled with that. And so and all of the evidence from the time capsules, just not being able to get rid of anything. It wasn't a collector collects things and shows them off and brings people in to see them. He didn't want anybody in his house. He didn't display his stuff in a way that a collector would. So that's why it has characteristics of what looks like hoarding disorder.
But is your conclusion in your chapter about him, so he's got all of these things, and oftentimes they're duplicates. And when you think about his great works of art, you write about the 210 Coca-Cola bottles or the 100 Marilyn Monroes or the 14 orange images of a mangled vehicle, et cetera, et cetera. Now, are you suggesting that that was really just an extension of his own mania, that he could not even not reproduce to excess his art, let alone his garbage?
I know. I think that's such an interesting question. I just sort of throw it out there because as I was researching him during the course of the book, I kept coming up with this image of him with multiple things around him, whether it was the stuff he hoarded or even conversations. He taped conversations, and there are thousands of hours of just inane conversations, just everyday stuff that collected. Even that, he collected his conversations. He collected people. He would go to parties with this entourage of people. And then, as you describe, his art seemed to always be these multiple images. It just struck me as really interesting and sort of maybe it's related somehow to his desire for excess.
Yeah, talk about coming full circle. And then the batteries he would use on the tape recorder to record the conversations, he would save those. He couldn't even get rid of those. So he is an example of a hoarder. You said that Howard Hughes had OCD, and we know Howard Hughes for a number of things, but you think central maybe was that, huh?
Well, people have really looked at that and his characteristics, and people may have seen the movie The Aviator where this was on display. He had such a strong fear of germs, and he wrote a lot of memos to the people who worked for him, and they all described you needed to use Kleenex to open the cabinet and 15 Kleenexes for this, and you know, to make a grilled cheese, you had to make it exactly in this manner. You couldn't do anything differently. And there were so many rules and regulations. He was so fearful about contamination that it really lines up with the characteristics of obsessive compulsive disorder. And it really inhibited him. By the end of his life, he was completely isolated and withdrawn from society. And it's really, in his case, too, he probably would have gotten much better treatment today.
Yeah, no kidding. Claudia Kalb's on the line. Her book is Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder. It's funny you mentioned this OCD. There's a lovely memoir called Just Checking by a woman who's writes about her OCD and that she's always checking things, the doorknob, the keys, everything. Did I turn off the faucet? And she would check it, as you might imagine, 25 times. But I've never heard people with that also express it verbally or in written form. He would say things and even write things over, the how a memo needed to be concise and precise. And then he would put that thought in sentence form 10 times in a letter to somebody, right?
Right. So repetition can be, it can be a repetition of action, like checking the door 25 times. It can also come out in language. It can be a repetition in language. And he would do that. He would repeat the same sentences. His workers noticed this when he was doing his filmmaking at some point, and he would repeat the same sentence and over again, and then write that again, as you mentioned, in his memos. And it's just one of the – all of these conditions, it's one of the ways it manifests, but all of these conditions are unique to the individual to some degree. So, one person may have a characteristic that comes out in the checking the doorknobs 25 times, and somebody else, it may show more in this way in terms of repetition of language and fear of germs in his case.
Everywhere you go now, people are saying, well, why didn't you do Brian Wilson? Where's this famous artist or composer? I suppose there was no end of people you could have included in the book.
Yes, that is so true. There are so many people out there, so especially you mentioned artists and creative people that are being studied now for mental health issues and the link to creativity, for example. I looked at a lot of people that I felt I wasn't quite ready to look at just because the medical research and evidence didn't seem strong enough. So there's a lot of just sort of hypotheses out there. And I wanted in each of these chapters to look for medical research, published studies, expert opinions that had already been raised and discussed, and then kind of unravel those in these chapters. But there are lots of people out there that would be really interesting to keep looking at.
Well, Brian Wilson is not only still alive, he's still touring. He's still actually re-performing. He's on a tour this year where he is redoing one of his albums up on stage, sort of the way Stevie Wonder did Songs in the Key of Life. Wilson is coming on stage and doing one of his great works. And it's interesting because in Wilson's case, like Marilyn Monroe's, it seems like each of them got way too close to their doctor, or their doctor got too close to them. You describe where Marilyn Monroe actually moved in with one of her analysts. Is that right?
Well, she was being seen by a very prominent psychoanalyst of the day. And in some ways, he felt that the treatment wasn't working, and he was trying to figure out how to help her. And he had the tools he had at the time, which are not the tools available today. And he thought if he brought her into the house and she became kind of a member of the family, that would maybe help replace what she was missing from her childhood. She didn't have ever that feeling of a family. So he did. He brought her in. She washed the dishes. She ate dinner with the family. She got to know the kids.
Okay, I'm no expert, but that sounds wrong. That sounds like a bad idea to me.
I think most people would say yes. That is, it just became much too interdependent and not a professional relationship.
Do you think, though, that, and this will sound like maybe a mean question or a weird question, but that some of these people have been propelled by their psychosis, maybe because the music or the vision for the architecture, maybe something came to them as a result of them being not entirely well?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a really interesting idea. And so, for example, Frank Lloyd Wright, I looked at narcissism, specifically narcissistic personality disorder. And in his case, the characteristics that that condition has, a sense of entitlement, a superiority, a grandiosity, and also a perfectionism, that did propel him to the heights of architecture because he was so sure of his aesthetic vision as being the absolute best. And he didn't like anything else. It was only his vision. And I think in that case, it did propel him. And there are interesting questions about Abraham Lincoln, who had these depressive episodes. And people have written about how his depression also gave him a sense of empathy and clarity and realism that made him a good leader and may have, in his case also, to get out of these moods and these funks, he would work. That was one of his ways of getting out of it. So there is this interesting concept that sometimes what brings you down can actually also, on the other side, propel you up.
I wonder if in a similar way, I want to talk about Lincoln a little bit, and then Princess Di, and then I'll let you go. Uh-huh. Claudia Kalb's on the line. Her book is Andy Warhol Was a Hoarder. But I wonder if you could say the same about drugs that maybe the Beatles or other great writers took. You know, they were either drunk or high when they were doing some of their great work. Maybe we would not have had those songs or novels without them, you know?
It's so interesting and true. Interesting to think about, because with the drugs or whatever you're doing to sort of release maybe some of the creativity in your mind or do something to get away from the everyday pressures that you might think about and not be able to tap into that creativity. I think it's an interesting concept, and I think whether it's an outside influence like a drug or a mental condition that may spur you on or in some ways be linked to creativity or drive. It's just such an area of science that's interesting and really evolving right now.
But you deal with so many different problems that people suffer from, the troubled minds of all of these people, borderline personality disorder, hoarding. Is there any common thread to either the illnesses or the best treatments for people that suffer from these things?
That's a really interesting question. I think in some of these cases, childhood experiences is one common thread, not in every case, but in a number of them. So Marilyn Monroe, we've talked about her difficult circumstances, the orphanage and the foster homes, that contributed, that seemed to, she didn't have a sense of identity and home. Frank Lloyd Wright, there's a lot of information about his mother sort of idealizing him, putting him up on a pedestal, and that can lead to narcissism, that the experts say, because these people just don't learn how to deal with reality. So that emerged, and losing a parent young, as Lincoln did, and Charles Darwin, who seemed to suffer from anxiety, losing a parent young. So a lot of childhood themes. And then in terms of treatment, I think in every case that now there are medications for many of these conditions. In a lot of cases, behavioral therapy and coping skills and life skills can really help. Each one is different, and each person is different in how he or she will respond. It's sometimes a combination is the best. So it's in each case, it's really a little bit of a trial and error with treatment to find the best for the individual.
Must be maddening to the researchers or the patients themselves, because if you have a certain physical ailment, I can almost predict how well you'll do with the pill with some margin of error. Here we can diagnose two people with the same illness, but the same treatment doesn't necessarily work for them all, right?
It's so true, and it is a problem, especially as you can imagine, if somebody is suffering, let's say, from depression, the first drug doesn't work. This person is suffering, wants to get out of this depressive mood that is inhibiting his life, and the drug isn't working. That can be even more of a problem, because it can send the person even into more of a sort of feeling of loss and hopelessness. So it is very challenging, and it's so different from just prescribing a blood pressure drug, and it's the same concept in terms of diagnosing. When you take heart disease or diabetes, you can measure things and diagnose them, and for mental health conditions, you can't do a blood test. You can't put a thermometer in someone's mouth. It's such a subjective experience, and the person has to be sharing the symptoms in a way that the doctor can understand and identify them. It's much more challenging.
So these characters we've described, plus Einstein and Darwin, Betty Ford for that matter, George Gershwin, the list goes on. Andy Warhol was a hoarder. Let's talk for a few more hours. Oh, wait, we can't. So, Claudia, that has to write another book, and we'll talk again, okay?
That would be great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well done. It's just out now. It's also 2:29. We'll catch up with the news next on WGN. Well, this is John Williams. You're listening to WGN Radio. That's Lady Gaga's David Bowie tribute from the Grammys. We always bump with a little bit of popular music, something that's in the news about this time on Saturdays, because we begin our Vibe Score segment where we score the news. You can get the app Vibe Score, one word, VibeScore, that my cousin Tom and I kind of dreamed up. And we'll feed you stories in groups or categories that are of interest to you. So in the music group this week, we asked you what you thought of Lady Gaga's David Bowie tribute. 1 to 100, you score the news. It's getting a 78 right now. I think that's about right. I gave it an 82. Griff's our producer. Kristen Decker normally joins us for this segment. She might chime in here. Is that you, Deck?
I'm out here in Skokie.
Yeah, you're getting ready to play with the boys from the beat, right?
Yes. That's going to go in out of context.
I want to put that in a different way. You're about ready to help the guys do their sports talk show. Am I right about that, Decker?
Yes, we're at the Blackhawks store, so I'm already looking at things I want to buy.
All right, so let's now jump in with the beat. You normally join us for this, or rather with Vibe Score. What did you give Lady Gaga's David Bowie tribute?
I thought it was super fun. I gave it in the high 80s or lower 80s.
How about you, Griff? Where are you on this one?
I was at a 70. She's an amazing performer. There's no denying it. I wasn't so crazy about it. And I couldn't put my finger on why. I kind of felt like it was more about her than it was him. But then I thought, does that matter? I don't know. I just wasn't super crazy about it. But you can't deny her talent. So 70.
I wanted it to be more of a tribute than a retrospective. I wanted her to do maybe two songs or, you know, I wanted her to do fewer songs and to do them well, because there were moments where I just thought, God, she's such a good entertainer. But then she's segueing on to the next tune, and then you got to ramp up for that one. And to me, they tried to do too much with it. I love her costume. I love her look. I love her singing. I love her dance moves. So
yeah,
78 is where it is right now.
I talked to, and so I had this problem like, oh, it should have been more of a tribute to him. But then I talked to David Bowie fans that absolutely loved it. And then some didn't like it at all, so it's kind of all over the place. I don't know how to feel about it, but the show itself, the Grammys, are getting a 39. So people like Lady Gaga.
I can't believe that. I didn't think the show was that bad.
I thought it was good. Better than usual.
Yeah. I don't know. I've never been so excited about the performers when they promote it, but I was really kind of jazzed about this thing. And then all they talked about the next day was that the microphone fell into the piano for Adele, which was...
Leave poor Adele alone.
Oh, my God. You know, then they talked about how the next day, how is she coping? She told Ellen she cried. Oh, my God, people were texting and tweeting about that. And I thought, well, when she goes home the next day, have you ever had a bad day at work? You're still beautiful, rich, young, and famous, and the greatest singer in the world. So you're good.
She had the best tweet. She said, a microphone fell into the piano, and I went to In-N-Out Burger afterwards.
That was her comfort food, huh?
Kristen and I were live blogging it for WGN Plus, and I was writing things like, this doesn't sound good. I don't know what the problem is. And I could feel Kristen ready to punch me in the face. She's like, don't talk about Adele that way. But it wasn't her fault, but I was just saying something was wrong, I could tell. But she handled it well.
One of my producers, a woman named Susan, was watching it with her kids, and they thought it was a mix issue. She goes, that guitar player is, they've got to cut him out, lose the guitar. But it was the piano strings. You guys both vibed on the viral video we posted in the viral group, the GoPro camera on the little kid playing hide and seek. Oh, my God, is that inventive. That is so much fun. I gave it a 90 on a scale of 1 to 100. They put a GoPro camera on the kid's head, and now he's hiding as dad's counting. And you can see him just like you were when you were a kid. It so takes you there. You look in the bathroom, left, right, no. Then you go to the closet. You kind of think about it. You can just see the kid's vision panning the upstairs. It's very, very surprisingly fun.
Watching it, I got a little bit of anxiety, the same anxiety I get when I'm playing hide-and-go-seek. Like, where are they? Where are they? Are they going to jump out and scare me?
I loved when he stands at the top of the stairs, and yeah, the scanning. And at the bottom of the video, it says, I love how you can tell that he's thinking.
Oh, yeah, you can.
Something about it. No, yeah, I give it like an 82.
I give it an 89.
Under news and current events, should we replace Antonin Scalia right now? I mean, that is within this term, right away. Or should we wait until the next president's term in January, whoever that is? So 100 is right away. 0 is absolutely wait until Obama's out of there. It's getting a 79. Our Vibers are leaning towards Obama should appoint and the Senate should at least consider and probably approve somebody. That's the way I read a 79 on this. But that's about where I am. To be honest with you, all I want is a transparent process. I want Brock to appoint somebody. I want the Senate to give it fair consideration. If he appoints somebody that's real liberal, you know, they'll never approve that guy, but let's at least have an open process. So I think 79 is about right.
Yep, I say appoint him now, and we're getting head nods out here in Skokie.
Incidentally, this one's very interesting because it's rare that we get a 50 on the button, which means the audience is perfectly divided on this. This is about Apple and the FBI. The FBI wants the Apple Corporation to invent a master key to hack into the terrorist's phone. If you said 100, that means you think the FBI is right. If you said 0, that means you think Apple is right in resisting their overtures. And it's exactly a 50 right now. The audience is completely divided.
I read that the opposite way because I thought it was if you score towards 100, you support Apple. And if you score a 0, you don't support Apple's decision because I love the phrase was rotten apple.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Okay. Well, then. But either way, at 50, the audience is divided. Whose side are you leaning towards on this, Deck?
Apple's. Definitely apples.
You are so against America then, and you want to help the terrorists. Am I correct in that?
No, I am about their decision to do whatever they want with their products.
I know. It's
very
complicated.
Christy McQuarrie, I heard her her opinion on this during the Mincing Rascals podcast, and she swayed me.
Yeah, she's a brave and wise, that Kristen McQuarrie, I'll say that. Best in show. We're talking about the movie, or are we talking about the dog here, Griffin? Best in show.
We could do both. I'm always
100
willing.
For the movie.
Yeah. I'd go 150 for the movie.
It is really good. You were asking, though, do you think this dog... Oh, no.
Yeah. It was the winning dog.
Yeah.
And we got a picture of him up there.
Yeah. And the question is at the Westminster Dog Show this year, do you want that dog as your pet? That dog is getting 73. We were laughing because our dogs are so corrupt compared to these champion dogs. I want them to put a three-legged wiener dog with a bad back, something that's in my house. I just love to see that dog try and make a go of it. I would root for that dog, not these perfect dogs.
They go to hand him the medal, and he snarls and snaps at him.
Totally, and he rolls over on his back.
That's your winner.
His coloring is wrong, and he's overweight. He's missing a tooth. Those are the kinds of dogs I have.
I was not excited about this Best in Show because I don't like dogs that shed, and just the name Shorthaired in the name of the dog, the German short-haired pointer, I was like, oh, no.
I'm not a fan of the new breeds. I like my nuts. I want to see more German Shepherds and Doberman Pinschers and Collies and Cocker Spaniels.
Well, you know, they do have the world's ugliest dog competition. Have you ever seen that?
I have.
And they always show the winner every year, and it's some horrifying dog. I don't know where they find them. But I think what you want is somewhere in the middle. We've got these perfect dogs, and we got these disgusting dogs.
I don't think there could be an ugly dog.
I shield my dog's eyes. I cannot relate to those. They're not even the same species as the ones.
They look like lizards, but... You want like the world's most average,
yes,
kind of annoying dog competition.
And exactly.
You got a couple winners, I think.
In my house, I do, yeah. There's a bunch of different categories, a bunch of different topics and questions. You get to score the news on VibeScore. You can download it right now at the App Store. It's one word, VibeScore. We'll include your scores in our tallies. Those are the numbers we're talking about. So, Deck, there's a lot of ambient sound there. Where exactly are you? You're in the Blackhawk store?
Yes, out at Old Orchard Shopping Center.
Old Orchard Shopping Center.
There's a lot of cool things out here. We're supposed to do fun things like ice skate, but it's 60, so there's not really any ice to go ice skating on.
The Blackhawks are playing outdoors at TCF Stadium in Minneapolis, and it's warmer than 40 degrees there right now.
Are you guys going to have a hockey game up there?
I think it's going to be a swim. We'll talk to the fellas in a minute. It's 2:49, and this is WGN.
Good afternoon, John.
That's Mark Carmen, and who else is over there?
Adam Hogue is here as well.
Hi, Adam.
We are at the really cool Blackhawk store here at Old Orchard Mall. It's the All-State Hometown Voices Tour, and we got an exciting show on a beautiful day to be at an outdoor mall.
John, yeah, no kidding. Good timing.
They're letting me wear a Patrick Kane All-Star jersey. I had to bribe a couple of the store managers, but I got it on. And some French fries.
Yeah, no kidding. What's an outdoor mall without food, right? I mean, right, you guys are experiencing the whole thing there. Is it game signed? Is it just a regular jersey, or is it one that Kaner actually wore?
Kaner has not worn this, nor has he signed it, but I think if he saw me in it, he'd want to, right?
Probably.
What's the prediction for the Blackhawks in the playoffs this year, guys?
Oh, it's got Stanley Cup or bust, right?
Am I right? We've won it 3 out of the last 6 years. Is that
That's correct.
Number on that?
Yeah.
Has that been done before? I guess it has been, right? I mean, I suppose we're in dynasty territory here, but did the Bruins once upon a time or somebody else have a run like
this? Well, the Canadians won like 100 in a row, I think, roughly 100, back in the 70s. So they have plenty of history. But the Hawks are trying to become the first team since the Red Wings, what was that, 15, 16 years ago, to win back-to-back titles. That's not easy to do anymore.
Yeah, 96, no 97.
It was the last time that was done? I watched the 34-30, the one about the 85 Bears last night.
Oh, and you finally got around to watching it?
Yeah, I know. Hey, did you hear about it? They did this thing. Yeah, I finally got around to it.
That's okay. That's what DVRs are for.
You know, it was actually on ESPN2, I think, last night. I was just sitting in a hotel room, and I was dialing around. They didn't have many channels, and all of a sudden that came up, and I thought, oh, I'll watch this thing. I wish they had spent – it was really well done. That was a good piece, wasn't it?
Yeah.
What was your favorite part, John?
Say it again.
What was your favorite part?
I really enjoyed just the general commentary of Hamp and Mongo. I thought they were really really interesting storytellers. And Mongo, you know, he made a great case for himself. You know, I'm crazy, but I'm not as dumb as I act. And I thought, in a way, him just in modern times talking about that past team was really compelling. I wish they had spent more time letting the offense talk, because it was really Jim McMahon and Butler, and I don't know who else. Obviously Walter can't talk, but I wish we would have heard more about the offensive end. But I guess it was a defensive story. It was a good show. It was really, really good.
No, you're right, and I've heard that criticism a lot, actually. I don't think it's a strong criticism. I think overall it was really well done. But I have heard a lot of people say, yeah, we want to hear more of the offense. Jim Suey did, or Matt Suey. I don't know who Jim Suey is.
Probably related.
Matt Suey did like a 2-hour interview with those guys, and he only appeared for like 15 seconds at one point.
I was wondering about that, yeah. And, I mean, they spent way too much time on the fridge. Once again, I think, as in real life, I think Walter Payton sort of got slighted. I wish they had shown more highlights of Walter Payton doing – there was a highlight reel, but they could have even shown more of Payton and the offense doing what they did.
Well, you know what's interesting about that is we talked to the director of the film,
Jason Hare,
and he actually said himself, he's like, I wish we could have gotten more Walter Payton highlights in there. The problem is, and this was his words, not mine, the problem is every single one of his runs is like 30 seconds long. So it's hard to cut that up in the shorter, a shorter montage.
I was thinking that actually driving around today. I was thinking about this show, and I thought, I know what it's like to edit a radio show. And if you try and sum up an entire NFL season and tell the story, every clip is got to be so finely tuned, right?
Yeah.
I'll bet it made him crazy. Well, listen, you guys are getting ready to do your show. So you're at Old Orchard, right?
Old Orchard Mall, we are at the Blackhawk store, which is on the north end of the mall. Let's see, we're right by next to the Bloomingdale's, and you'll see a bunch of kids out here playing street hockey. So it's a pretty cool setup we got.
We'll be listening, fellas. Have a good show. I got one more thing to say here, and that is congratulations to Cynthia Kraft. Cynthia Kraft won our gift set from Chamonix. Everybody else, you can order that stuff at 1-800-457-0121. But you can quit calling Griff, because Cynthia is our winner. The news is around the corner on GN.